This is the lecture for December. It is being made in the last week of December 1993. The title is Europe in Prophecy. The next 10 to 20 years ahead of us will witness some major changes in the history of the world. Though the prime players in world events will begin to focus geographically in the Middle East, and around Jerusalem in particular, there will be some visible economic and political changes that will take place in especially Asia, but also North America will play a profound role in all these historical events. And this will include as well the nations on the European continent. Obviously, Europe is a very large section of real estate here on this earth. It is also very close to the Middle East. It is even close to Asia and a part of Europe, a bridges to Asia in the East, as we all know. You cannot get rid of Europe when you talk about the important events to take place in the next few years ahead of us. Europe will play a profound part, along with North America, South America, but particularly North America and Asia. But events will begin to coalesce around the Middle East as far as importance is concerned. And this will certainly be the case as far as the prophetic teachings of the Bible are brought into view. It is the Middle East that we need to pay attention to. Within the next 30 years, the Middle East will be a very different place than it is now, and it will become very powerful. But Europe will change too. Europe is close to the Middle East, as I said before. And you know, all of us really today in this last part of the 20th century, because we have so many facilities for transportation, all of us are very close to one another throughout the world. The United States, for example, is almost as close to the Middle East as Europe. Now, not geographically, of course, but when we come to the idea or the knowledge that we can get anywhere in the world very quickly these days, and in fact can actually go around the world in a little over an hour's time in outer space, we can know that this world is a very small place in which we live at the present time. All of us are going to be caught up in the world events to take place in the next 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. And the Bible has a tremendous amount of information to tell us of what will be happening in that period of time. It particularly is interested in the last 7 years of human history prior to the second advent of Jesus Christ back to this earth. And that event has not happened yet, as we all know. But it is prophesied to occur. And I haven't the slightest doubt that Jesus Christ is right there ready to come back just exactly on time that the Father has scheduled for him to arrive here on earth. And the Bible has a lot to say about the events preceding that second advent, particularly of a seven-year period that will be in advance of it. And what happens in that seven-year period, which we find recorded predominantly in Daniel and also the book of Revelation, but let us not forget Zechariah 10 and 11 and 12, 13 and 14. Those verses are as apocalyptic almost as you find in Daniel and the book of Revelation. Now the word apocalyptic, it means dealing with end time events. Once we can get a overall scenario of those end times events as we find in Daniel and Zechariah and in the book of Revelation, we can then fit in many prophecies from Isaiah and Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and also the Psalms, and even going all the way back to the time of Moses to be able to find out what God is going to do here on this earth in the next few years in advance of us. And certainly the European continent is going to be playing a major role, but all of us on earth are going to be in this cauldron of prophetic events that is going to be taking place as we look on the near horizon just in front of us. And Europe is important. In actual fact, I've just returned from a trip to London and to Europe. My wife Ramona and I were able to get some very reasonable Eurail passes for unrestricted train travel throughout most of Western Europe. Very pleasingly, for 15 days, we could go anywhere we wanted and when we wanted, as long as there was a train going there. This is one of the most economical ways to get around Europe, and because their train systems that they have there are very different than they are here in the United States, they're very up to date. In actual fact, on one train that we took from Paris to Marseille in the south of France, we were traveling 180 miles an hour on some of the straight stretches. That's right, I did not say 180 kilometers, I said 180 miles an hour, almost 300 kilometers an hour. Some of those beautiful trains that they have there in France, and they are starting to build, I understand, in Germany, and we're talking about doing somewhat here in the United States, but we're dragging our feet, it seems like. Some of those trains are some of the most beautiful that you can imagine, and it's easy to get around Europe. If you can get one of these Eurail passes, it's amazing how economical it can be. What we would do is to go from place to place, and then we would get to the area we were going to, and then early in the evening, and then go to the tourist desk there at the train station, and you could get a hotel pretty reasonable near the train station, and stay there for 2 to 3 days to do the business that I had to do, and then we could go on to the next place we wanted to. This was a very wonderful way of getting research information. In actual fact, that's the reason I went there in the first place, because I wanted to get some pictures, which I did, by the way, and much historical material, written material, which I also got, for my two new books that I hope to produce in 1994 and going up into 1995. I have got quite a good number of pictures and historical material, especially from the Louvre in Paris, and particularly at the Vatican Museum in Rome. And we also went to the Pergamon Museum, which was in Berlin, East Berlin. We were able to get around for 15 days. In actual fact, we were on the continent for about 20-some days. And it was a very wonderful experience to be able to be down where the grassroots level of the people are, you know, where you can talk to them on their own level, where you're not just going from airport to airport, but when you're traveling by train, you're down on the ground, and it's possible to talk to many people on board the train, as well as wherever you go. It is one way that I have been able to garner a tremendous amount of information, historical and I might say prophetical, as a result, and political and all of that, and economical, as a result of doing things of this nature. And this was no exception. I was very, very pleased with the information that we were able to gain from this trip. And I now have some beautiful pictures which I think you're going to rejoice in, dealing with the ancient idolatry, how it crept into the Christian churches, and that we now in Christendom happen to be an idolatrous organization. In no way is mainline Christendom today like the pristine church or ecclesia as it was in the time of Christ or in the first 3 centuries when the church or the ecclesia was here on earth. At the time of Constantine the Great, around 325 AD, at the time of the Nicene Council, there was a profound change that took place in the whole attitude of Christianity. That's where the teachings turned from Christianity into what I call churchianity. And for the next 50 to 75 years, there was an organization established which was no more Christian than a $3 bill. It actually was nothing more than a perpetuation and a continuation of paganism, and only the names were changed. Instead of Zeus or Serapis, they changed the name into Jesus. And they took over almost all, of the customs, the rituals, the practices of ancient paganism. And they blended it into what they call New Testament Christianity. In actual fact, what happened, it wasn't that New Testament Christianity cleaned up paganism. It was paganism that vitiated New Testament Christianity. And for the last 1,600 and almost 1,700 years, we have been subjected to many of the doctrines and teachings of paganism which came out of that period from Constantine the Great onward. And in the museums of Europe, you will find evidence which is so clear for people to see if you can only bring people's attention to it. In Rome, I should say in London, for example, Ramona and I went to the City of London Museum, which is in the City of London, not a part of the British Museum, but a different one altogether. And it shows the history of the City of London. And there in the late 300s AD, they discovered in the City of London an ancient temple to Mithras, which was the Persian sun god, just another form of Zeus when you think about it, or Serapis. And indeed, in the temple, they found a bust, a head, in stone of Serapis. And they have displayed that in this London Museum for the past almost 40 years. I asked the caretaker there, who was over that very region, how many people have called attention to the fact that that Serapis there, who is none other than Zeus, looked almost precisely like Jesus Christ is portrayed today. He looked at me and he said, you know, I've been working here for 15 years, and I have often thought that myself, of the close resemblance. But he said, sir, you are the first one in 15 years that has ever brought that to my attention that was interested in it. And in fact, I was there last year at the same time, in the same area, and I asked another man about the same question, and he said the same thing to me. People do not seem to get the connection. Well, they ought to get the connection, and that's what we are here for. We are here to show how history has actually all the truth, all the proofs to show that Christianity today is nothing more than rebaptized paganism, and it's all there in the museums of Europe. You ought to take a trip like we did and to see them. And even in the Vatican Museum itself, it is amazing the number of Serapis heads that are there that I'll tell you right down in the next room. They will have pictures of the so-called Jesus, and they look exactly the same. You can hardly see the difference between them. And that's in the Vatican in Rome. They ought to know better than what they are doing and what they are perpetuating. And wherever we go, it seems like in the Western world, and even in our Protestant churches, we see Zeus displayed and all types of heathen pagan doctrines. It's no wonder that this world is so upset and so far away from the teachings of the Bible. In this trip that we took, we were able, after going to London, to be with my daughter Kathy. She has lived there now she was born there, of course, and we came over from London to a college in Pasadena when Kathy was 13 years of age. And then about 12 years ago, she decided to go back to London because she could work in London. She was born in England and had English citizenship as well as American. And she married there and has been there ever since. And I now have two granddaughters, and they live in London. Ramona and I were able to stay with Kathy to visit them and stay there free of charge. Of course, that made it very handy and all of that. But I also got these URL passes so that I could go to the various museums and libraries in certain places in Europe. Let me first tell you about the trip, simply to let you know that we went all over the main areas of Europe. So this lecture that I'm giving you here on Europe in Prophecy, I want to bring you up to date on what is happening in Europe right now, and to show you where we have been and keeping our fingers on the pulse of what was happening right now, politically, economically, socially, and religiously in these regions. And it's most important. I first went to Europe in 1957, 58, I beg your pardon, is when it was. And then I've been to Europe so many times, having lived in England for 14 years. So I have kept my fingers on that proverbial pulse of what is happening in Europe. I've been very, very interested in it. And so for the last 35 years, I have had the opportunity of observing all areas of Europe and being in every European country, in most places, several times the times that I have over the past 20 or 35 years, is what I meant to say. And so this time I thought we would take these URL passes, and I planned a trip where we went from London to Paris and then from to the Louvre Museum. I wanted to see that. And then from there, down south to the Mediterranean, to Marseille, and over to Nice on the Riviera. We went through Monaco and then into Rome, and we went to Vatican Museum there. We also went down to Pompeii. I wanted to show Ramona the ruins of Pompeii. I haven't seen that area for about 30 years, and my, what improvements they have made since I've seen it. If you ever get a chance to go into Italy, you should certainly go down to Pompeii and to see the ruins of that ancient city. It was destroyed in 79 A.D., and that is the time when the Apostle Paul, John was living, and just 9 years after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and within the generation of the apostles. That's when Mount Vesuvius, the volcano there, blew its top, and ash came all over the city, and the remains of that have been uncovered over the past 150 years. And they've done tremendous work on it in the past 20. So it is certainly worthwhile to see what an ancient town would have looked like in the period of the apostles in ancient Italy. And it was there in the time of the apostles. And that's very, very instructive. And you'll see that much of what they were teaching at that time is not really much different than our churches are teaching today, though they were using pagan terms and pagan teachings outright back at that time. We went to the Vatican Museum, and I photographed literally hundreds of busts of various men, dignitaries, and all of that who lived at the time. Primarily, in one case, is to show that short hair on people of Greece and Rome was by nature what they wore. In all periods of time, very seldom would you ever find anyone with long hair. Now, you would find the gods having long hair. That is true. But very seldom would you find any human being, be he from Caesar on down, or the various Caesars, or senators, or other people of Rome. Very seldom would you find anyone with hair that would even come down to the shoulders. And yet we are told in this world today that Jesus wore long hair because it was customary for everyone who was a philosopher or a teacher to wear long hair in those times. It is true that philosophers, some of them did wear long hair, but the Apostle Paul wasn't talking to philosophers in 1 Corinthians there when he was talking to the Christians. He was talking to ordinary people, and he says, nature says it is wrong for a person to have long hair. And the apostle, a male, a human female is just the opposite. But he said it was wrong. And he said nature itself ought to show a person that. And then he went on to say that a male should have short hair because they are in the image of God and the image of Christ. And obviously they have short hair. And in the Bible it makes it abundantly clear that the priests of God, who represented God in the temple at Jerusalem, they wore their hair short because they looked like God. They represented God. And there it is in the Bible. But what do we have today? Just exactly the opposite. It seems like that if God says, don't wear long hair, that's the very thing they will do, and putting it upon Jesus himself. Well, in the Vatican Museum, I photographed at least 300 different statues or busts of prominent men in Greece, Rome, and even from Palestine, in those areas in there, a few of them, and all of them have short hair. Of course they do. This nonsense that everybody was wearing long hair at the time is just that. It's complete nonsense. You have to take these trips and see these things for yourself, and it's amazing how that people right in the area of the Vatican, they will show Jesus with long hair in all of the other pictures dealing with him since the time of Constantine the Great. And yet when it shows the ordinary people who lived in the time of Christ throughout the Roman world, there's not a one of them that has short hair of any consequence. It is most amazing. We went from Rome up to Venice and northern Italy, and then across the Brenner Pass into Munich, and from Munich we went to Berlin. Berlin is now a united city. It is a part of Germany, the greater Germany, and West Germany now and East Germany are no more. Well, they are different, but they are one country. And yet we found that in the East, though Berlin has been united now for a little over 2 years, there are very great differences between the two. In fact, in East Berlin, where we stayed in a hotel, it was a very nice hotel, very reasonable as a matter of fact, but the facilities there were such that we couldn't even get our washing done. It was impossible. They didn't have any facilities for doing that. And it reminded me of the old communist days when I was there. And indeed, outside where there was Karl Marx Alley still there, and Engels Platz, and Lenin's this and Lenin's that, all over the place. They haven't even changed any of those names. In actual fact, Germany at the present time is quite a divided nation, very definitely so, economically and other ways as well. And they're making amends. Now, I'm not saying that they're not coming together, but it's going to take much longer time for the two Germanys to come together than most people would have imagined. You see, Germany is a very big country of 80 million people. And the Germans in the south, in Bavaria, and let's say going over into Austria, which is a different country, but they're Germans too, they have different temperaments from one another than those in the north or those in old Prussia and areas like that. And we are seeing right now in Germany quite a number of conflicts going on between the East and the West. And certainly there is a vast difference even in the architecture and in the way that the people think. And we're seeing it quite clearly, but we did, between the East Germans and the West Germans, though they represent one country at the present time. We went to the Pergamon Museum there, which has divided some of its artifacts into another museum on the west side of Berlin. And we missed a few that I wanted to see. However, in that Pergamon Museum, they have what they call the Altar of Zeus, which was at Pergamum. And they were able to get most of that, and they brought it up to Germany some 70 or 80 years ago, and they reconstructed it there. And this Altar of Zeus is very beautiful because it explains all about the history of the gods and the goddesses as referred to by Homer in the Iliad and the Odyssey. And it has it all there in front of you. And the interesting thing about it is that if you'll read the book of Revelation, when it comes to the church at, or the ecclesia at Pergamos, it says in the book of Revelation, John said, that is where Satan's seat is. And all of that ruins, or virtually all of it now, is in the Pergamon Museum. It's very beautiful to see, and if you ever get to the area of Berlin, you should see it. It's one museum you should not miss, and also the Vatican Museum, as I said, in Rome. But some of the artifacts there in the Pergamon Museum are most interesting because they show some ancient Assyrian priests coming on in bas-relief form, carved in rock, and they're there for everyone to see, which have mitres on their heads. And the mitres are the same type of mitres that bishops, archbishops, and popes are using now in the various hierarchical churches of Christianity, which came into existence about 1,000 years ago. They decided to adopt the old fish hat, as it's called, of Dagon the fish god. And you know, Dagon the fish god is mentioned in the Old Testament. That was the god that the Philistines were worshiping. That was the god that Samson was going contrary against. That was the god that Samson, in his last endeavor, was able to put his hands against two columns, blinded as he was, and he did not have his strength. They thought he didn't, but as a last gesture of his power and of showing who was God, was it Yahweh or was it Dagon, Samson was able, with his two arms, to cause the whole temple of Dagon to collapse, and Dagon's statue fell over on its face. Now that was from the Philistines there. You'll see the same thing on Assyrian monuments, but the priests of Dagon are absolutely dressed, I mean almost to a T, like you'll see the Pope is dressed in his mitres today, or in the mitres of archbishops and bishops in other churches like the Episcopal Church and so forth. Now some people may think that that is not important. Well, let me tell you this. In the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, it talks about mystery Babylon, secret Babylon. And what we find is Babylon and its teachings being perpetuated in this world. But they are so-called secret. They're secret, they're mysterious, as far as the world is concerned. But they shouldn't be secret to you, and they shouldn't be secret to me. That is why when I go to these places, I get pictures of these things, get the history behind them, and I put them out for the general public to know that what they're in is Babylon, which has its name now Christianity, or as I call it, churchianity. We went from Berlin to Copenhagen, which was in Denmark, and that was very nice, and then over into Sweden, just the southern Sweden for a while. Then we went back to Amsterdam in Holland, and from Amsterdam back to London. I was able in that trip with Ramona to cover about 2,000 some odd miles in Europe. I think it was about 2,500 altogether, maybe more than that. And it was a very interesting trip because I have found out that Europe today is trying to unite. In fact, the economic community, as they used to call it, of Europe is now officially known as the European Union. They're calling it the Union. But it is a union in the sense of trying to become economically together. They're wanting to have later on a one currency for all of the nations that belong to the European Union. They're trying desperately to bring that into pass, and they're hoping before the turn of the century to have that. Now, European economic cooperation is going on at a good pace, and it seems like it is going to be successful to a certain extent. But let me tell you this, when it comes to ethnic divisions, when it comes to religious divisions, when it comes to divisions dealing with temperaments and things like that of the different peoples, the nations of Europe are as divided as they were 30 and 40 years ago when I first went over there. And that is a fact. In actual fact, I would say because that the Cold War has now ended and there is no external threat there that would cause Europe to want to bind together into one unit of some kind to be able for protection purposes to perpetuate the European nations and so forth. Without that Cold War, we now find that nations are beginning to squabble with one another. And not only that, they're squabbling inside nations, inside the various nations. 2 years ago, Belgium again was just on the verge of splitting up. They've mended some of the fences since, I understand. But in Italy, I was surprised. I've known for years that northern Italy and southern Italy have always been, since the time of Garibaldi, when he united the country in the middle of the last century, it was always tenuous between north and south. But still there, even right now, at this moment, you will find that there are forces divide Italy into two or even more countries, believe it or not. And that is a fact. Italy and many of the newspapers that we were reading there in Italy were saying that Italy has become almost ungovernable as a people because of the internal strifes that are going on inside Italy itself. Now all you have to do is to go across the Adriatic Sea and you're right into Bosnia. You're into Herzegovina, you're into Serbia, you're into Croatia. Going south, you're into Macedonia of the Balkans, and then finally you're into Greece. And then over a little farther to the west, you're in Albania. Those regions in there are as diverse as they possibly can be, mainly religiously, and other ways too, certain ethnic differences. And we're hearing of the civil wars that are going on there all the time. Since the breakup of the Cold War, we find that Yugoslavia, which was a united nation, you know, for some time there after the Second World War under Tito. But as soon as Tito went his way, and as soon as the Cold War ended, well, these people here in the Central Balkans region began to fight with one another, and it's going on to this very day. And let me tell you this. if there is a truce or truces that will be manipulated in the next few years in the area of Bosnia and Serbia and Herzegovina, they may be truces, but at the same time, they're not going to be able to be put into effect. There are always going to be problems in that area, no matter what. And the same thing happens in other areas. Do you know in Spain, when we were looking at that situation there, that the difficulties in Spain are not as rosy as some people might think. There are different regional areas there where the people are very different from one another, though they are under one banner called the Spanish government. Spain, I should say France, is rather homogeneous in some ways. But when you get up to Britain even, do you know there are in Scotland a nationalist group of people that actually want Scotland to be separated from the United Kingdom? And then what we have in Northern Ireland, right to this very time, we're having discussions on whether Northern Ireland is going to be a part of Great Britain, have an independence of its own, perhaps, or be a part of the southern state of Ireland. Who knows what is happening and will happen immediately in those regions there. Europe is not a homogeneous area at all. And there is a difference between North and South with many of these people. I was really surprised to find out that even in Holland, as stable as it is, you'll find that the people south of the Rhine River, and that's a great quantity of them, think quite differently than the people north of the Rhine. Now, I don't mean it's the place where they're fighting one another all the time, you know, and fist fights and things like that, but you'll find that the people are quite different from each other. And along the coast, going up into Denmark, you will find that there are various groups of people that differ from the other Germans. And between South Germany and North Germany, there are differences. Europe is a very difficult country, or area, I should say, to bring together. People have known this over the years, and they have wondered how in the world will Europe actually come together to be one federal state in the future. It would be very difficult for that to occur. And let me tell you this, it is, in my view, it is not going to occur in the next 10 to 20 years. There would have to be some strong man that would come up that all people in Europe would recognize as important. And also, it would have to be, you'd think, some external threat. That means that all European countries need to get together for their preservation's sake, or something like that. Right at the moment, and for the next few years in advance of us, there doesn't seem to be any historical or prophetic scenario that would suggest anything like that happening. And though there could be, and no doubt will be, economic union continuing, and that they will pool many of their resources, as far as Europe is concerned for the next 10 or 20 years, the trend now in Europe is really holding on to the national states as they are, lest they break up, some of them. Now, I think that they will not break up entirely. The people have to realize that it is for everyone's benefit that nations stay together. But on the other hand, the Bible shows quite clearly that at the breakup of Babylon back there in the 6th century B.C., that every man wanted to return to his own people. And, you know, that's mentioned several times in the book of Jeremiah. And that's exactly what is happening in Europe at the present time. Now, if you have a tremendous power threatening you, like the Soviet Union in the past, all the nations of Western Europe who have a common bond as being democracies, so to speak, would want to get together for preservation's sake. But with the Soviet Union gone, and with the East breaking up, and with Russia now and the Ukraine at odds with one another, and so forth and so on, we find out that the trend is just like it says in the book of Jeremiah, at the capitulation of the old Babylonian kingdom, that everyone wants to return to his own people, to be ruled by his own type of government, his own type of religion, and so forth and so on. And in my 2,500-mile trip throughout Europe, I have found that quest has not diminished at all anywhere in Europe, though there is the trend philosophically amongst all people that they should come together. Well, yes, they can see it in their heads, but when it comes to put it into practice in their hearts, it's very difficult to do so. While we were in Nice, we got on the train there, and on the way to Italy and down to Rome, we met a Canadian couple that were very nice, about our age, Ramona's age and mine, and the next day when we got to Rome, they wanted to go with us, because I was a historian, and I talked to them about history and so forth of the area, and some prophetical things I mentioned to them, and so they went with us wherever we went on the next day, and they were only going to be in Rome for 2 days, and then they finally left. But he and she were from Quebec in Canada. Now, we all know that there are problems in Canada for a breakup. Now, this gentleman was saying, and he was born and reared in Montreal, but he was of Italian stock. He could speak Italian. His father and mother had come from northern Italy near Venice and as a child, and he was reared where he could speak Italian. But he also spoke French fluently because of being in Montreal, and of course his English was fluent. Now, it was his own personal opinion, and there everybody in Canada has a right to have his own or her own, we know that. But he said, you know what I think we ought to do is to let Quebec just go ahead and try independence for a while and see what it's like and see if they like it that way. That was his opinion. Now, that may not be the opinion of some others, but there are lots of people even in Canada who feel that Canada ought to be broken up into various states. Well, now, what about the United States? We do not have that going on here at the present time, but we do have racial problems, do we not? Yes. And what do we find people at the present doing? They're wanting to retreat into their own racial groups, and believe it or not, that is going to continue. You're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years, whether it's in the United States, whether it's in Canada, whether it's in Europe, or even in Asia and places like that, that once you have the external threat of war taken away from you, you're going to find that people begin to retreat into themselves. They begin to be wanting to be like their own people. They do not want to reach out and have an international outlook on things, except when it would be in the economic sphere, so that people would be prosperous and things like that. So in Europe today, there is quite a good deal of division, especially in ethnic matters, in religious matters, and other things like that. When it comes to economics, however, all of them seem to think that they should cooperate one with another. So what is going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years in Europe as far as prophecy is concerned? Well, it's going to be this. Prophecy is centered in the Middle East, and Europe and North America and Asia are going to figure into those prophecies as we impinge our activities on Middle Eastern affairs. And in the Bible, it does say that there is a major event to occur in Europe in the next few years in advance of us, which will fit into the end time scenario. Now, on the B side of this tape, I'm going to explain what that is. And it's most important for us to realize it, because it has not been understood by people who have dealt with the prophecies over the years. It's most important that we realize that prophecy is about to be fulfilled to the dotting of the I and the crossing of the T. I do not doubt that for a moment. But you know, the prophecies have been misunderstood by people. I have misunderstood prophecies in the past and still do to this day, no doubt. But we are growing in grace and in knowledge. And the Bible says in Daniel chapter 12, verses 4 and 9, that as we get closer to the end, knowledge, the knowledge of prophecy, will begin to be known as never before. And God is going to open the doors. He's going to take away the curtains so that we'll be able to understand some of these prophetical events that will affect your lives, your life in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and even up to 30 years. And all of those in Europe, there is a, I would like to say this, I'm going to call an event to your mind in a few moments from the book of Daniel that I want you to pay close attention to. I do not know all of the ramifications of this event yet, but I am going to call your attention to it. I've known of these things for about 10 to 15 years, but right now, as a result of this trip to Europe and thinking very seriously on this whole matter, I want to bring to your attention in just a few moments on the B side of this lecture some interesting material from the book of Daniel, which deals with Europe. That's right, in its relationship to the Middle East. Now, as I said before, when it comes to prophetic understanding, it is the Middle East that is the focus of God's attention. It's that way in the Old Testament. It's that way in the New Testament. But we are a very small world today. What happens in the Middle East will be known in all the rest of the world instantaneously through the type of communications that we have today. And in fact, the waves, the political, the economic, and the social waves that are generated in Jerusalem and in Israel and in other areas of the Middle East, they span outward to cover the entire earth in a matter of seconds. And we find, not only as time it goes quickly, that the economic effects can also go just as quickly. We are all involved in this world in what is going to happen in the Middle East. And Europe in particular is going to be involved in it. Now, in the past, we have noticed prophetical individuals saying Europe will play a profound role. Excuse me for coughing here. I'm still getting over my flu, so I hope you don't mind if I cough once in a while here. I've been about 8 or 10 days with the flu here after I got back from that trip, and I'm just now getting over it. So if I stumble once in a while, I hope you'll understand why, but I think I can continue on without any difficulty here. But in the past, we find prophetical interpreters trying to show that Europe will be the focal point of prophecy at the end time, with the rising up of 10 nations in Europe, headed by a beast whom some people feel would be the Pope, and that the Pope leading the nations of Europe under a common bond of religion would be the anti-Christian system that would fight against Christ when he comes. How many times have you heard that? Well, I'll tell you, it's been preached and preached and preached for the last almost 1,000 years, if that's of what will happen. And when the Protestant Reformation came up, that theory was put into vogue time and time again. And it's been with us, and in almost all the commentators or commentaries, you will find that Europe is to play a profound role in the Antichrist system that is to come. What we find in the Bible, however, and I will show on the B side of this tape, is that the Antichrist will actually come out of the Middle East. And Europe will have something to do with it, but the 10 nations mentioned in Daniel and mentioned in Revelation are not 10 nations in Europe. They are 10 nations in the Middle East. Please turn over the cassette tape at this juncture for the B section of Europe in Prophecy.